There were many houses in all parts of Malking in which he confiscated the window light from enemy eyes. On some of his work days, Liesel went with him. They carted his paint through town, smelling the hunger on some of the streets, and shaking their heads at the wealth on others. Many times on the way home, women with nothing but kids and poverty would come running out and plead with him to paint their blinds. "Frau Haller, I'm sorry, I have no black paint left," he would say. But a little farther down the road, he would always break. There was Tall Man and Long Street. "Tomorrow," he'd promise. "First thing." And when the next morning dawned, there he was, painting those blinds for nothing, or for a cookie or a warm cup of tea. The previous evening, he'd have found another way to turn blue or green or beige to black. Never did he tell them to cover their windows with spare blankets, for he knew they'd need them when winter came. He was even known to paint people's blinds for half a cigarette, sitting on the front step of a house, sharing a smoke with the occupant. Laughter and smoke rose out of the conversation before they moved on to the next job. When the time came to write, I remember clearly what Liesel Memminger had to say about that summer. A lot of the words have faded over the decades. The paper has suffered from the friction of movement in my pocket, but still many of her sentences have been impossible to forget. A small sample of some girl-written words. "That summer was a new beginning, a new end. When I look back, I remember my slippery hands of paint and the sound of Papa's feet on Munich Street, and I know that a small piece of the summer of 1942 belonged to only one man. Who else would do some painting for the price of half a cigarette? That was Papa. That was typical, and I loved him." Every day when they worked together, he would tell Liesel his stories. There was the Great War, and how his miserable handwriting helped save his life, and the day he met Mama. He said that she was beautiful once, and actually very quiet-spoken. "Hard to believe, I know, but absolutely true." Each day there was a story, and Liesel forgave him if he told the same one more than once. On other occasions, when she was daydreaming, Papa would dab her lightly with his brush, right between the eyes. If he misjudged and there was too much on it, a small path of paint would dribble down the side of her nose. She would laugh and try to return the favor, but Hans Hubermann was a hard man to catch out at work. It was there that he was most alive. Whenever they had a break to eat or drink, he would play the accordion, and it was this that Liesel remembered best. Each morning, while Papa pushed or dragged the paint cart, Liesel carried the instrument. "Better that we leave the paint behind," Hans told her, "than ever forget the music." When they paused to eat, he would cut up the bread, smearing it with what little jam remained from the last ration card. Or he'd lay a small slice of meat on top of it. They would eat together, sitting on their cans of paint, and with the last mouthful still in the chewing stages, Papa would be wiping his fingers, unbuckling the accordion case. Traces of breadcrumbs were in the creases of his overalls. Paint-specked hands made their way across the buttons and raked over the keys, or held onto a note for a while. His arms worked the bellows, giving the instrument the air it needed to breathe. Liesel would sit each day with her hands between her knees in the long legs of daylight. She wanted none of those days to end, and it was always with disappointment that she watched the darkness stride forward. As far as the painting itself was concerned, probably the most interesting aspect for Liesel was the mixing. Like most people, she assumed her papa simply took his cart to the paint shop or hardware store and asked for the right color, and away he went. She didn't realize that most of the paint was in lumps, in the shape of a brick. It was then rolled out with an empty champagne bottle. Champagne bottles, Hans explained, were ideal for the job, as their glass was slightly thicker than that of an ordinary bottle of wine. Once that was completed, there was the addition of water, whiting, and glue, not to mention the complexities of matching the right color. The science of Papa's trade brought him an even greater level of respect. It was well and good to share bread and music, but it was nice for Liesel to know that he was also more than capable in his occupation. Competence was attractive. One afternoon, a few days after Papa's explanation of the mixing, they were working at one of the wealthier houses just east of Munich Street. Papa called Liesel inside in the early afternoon. They were just about to move on to another job when she heard the unusual volume in his voice. Once inside, she was taken to the kitchen, where two older women and a man sat on delicate, highly civilized chairs. The women were well-dressed. The man had white hair and sideburns like hedges. Tall glasses stood on the table. They were filled with crackling liquid.
"Well," said the man, "here we go."
He took up his glass and urged the others to do the same. The afternoon had been warm. Liesel was slightly put off by the coolness of her glass. She looked at Papa for approval. He grinned and said,
"Prost, Mädel. Cheers, girl."
Their glasses chimed together, and the moment Liesel raised it to her mouth, she was bitten by the fizzy, sickly, sweet taste of champagne. Her reflexes forced her to spit straight onto her Papa's overalls, watching it foam and dribble. A shot of laughter followed from all of them, and Hans encouraged her to give it another try. On the second attempt, she was able to swallow it and enjoy the taste of a glorious broken rule. It felt great. The bubbles ate her tongue. They prickled her stomach. Even as they walked to the next job, she could feel the warmth of pins and needles inside her. Dragging the cart, Papa told her that those people claimed to have no money.
"So you asked for champagne?"
"Why not?"
He looked across, and never had his eyes been so silver.
"I didn't want you thinking that champagne bottles are used only for rolling paint,"
he warned her. "Just don't tell Mama."
"Agreed."
"Can I tell Max?"
"Sure, you can tell Max."
In the basement, when she wrote about her life, Liesel vowed that she would never drink champagne again, for it would never taste as good as it did on that warm afternoon in July. It was the same with accordions.
Many times she wanted to ask her Papa if he might teach her to play, but somehow something always stopped her. Perhaps an unknown intuition told her that she would never be able to play it like Hans Hubermann. Surely not even the world's greatest accordionists could compare. They could never be equal to the casual concentration on Papa's face. Or there wouldn't be a paintwork-traded cigarette slouched on the player's lips. And they could never make a small mistake with a three-note laugh of hindsight. Not the way he could. At times in that basement, she woke up tasting the sound of the accordion in her ears. She could feel the sweet burn of champagne on her tongue. Sometimes she just sat against the wall, longing for the warm finger of paint to wander just once more down the side of her nose, or to watch the sandpaper texture of her Papa's hands. If only she could be so oblivious again, to feel such love without knowing it, mistaking it for laughter, and bread with only the scent of jam spread out on top of it. It was the best time of her life. But it was bombing carpet. Make no mistake. Bold and Bright, a trilogy of happiness would continue for summer's duration and into autumn. It would then be brought abruptly to an end, for the brightness had shown suffering the way. Hard times were coming, like a parade.
Duden Dictionary, meaning number one. Zufriedenheit, happiness, coming from happy, enjoying pleasure and contentment. Related words, joy, gladness, feeling fortunate or prosperous. The Trilogy. While Liesel worked, Rudy ran. He did laps of Hubert Oval, ran around the block, and raced almost everyone from the bottom of Himmel Street to Frau Diller's, giving varied head starts. On a few occasions, when Liesel was helping Mama in the kitchen, Rosa would look out the window and say, "What's that little Saukerl up to this time?
All that running out there.
Liesel would move to the window.
At least he hasn't painted himself black again.
Well, that's something, isn't it?
Rudy's reasons. In the middle of August, a Hitler Youth carnival was being held, and Rudy was intent on winning four events. The 1500, 400, 200, and of course, the 100. He liked his new Hitler Youth leaders, and wanted to please them, and he wanted to show his old friend Franz Deutscher a thing or two.
Four gold medals, he said to Liesel one afternoon when she did laps with him at Hubert Oval. Like Jesse Owens back in 36. You're not still obsessed with him, are you?
Rudy's feet rhymed with his breathing.
Not really, but it would be nice, wouldn't it? It would show all those bastards who said I was crazy. They'd see that I wasn't so stupid after all. But can you really win all four events?
They slowed to a stop at the end of the track, and Rudy placed his hands on his hips.
I have to.
For 6 weeks he trained, and when the day of the carnival arrived in mid-August, the sky was hot-sunned and cloudless. The grass was overrun with Hitler youths, parents, and a glut of brown-shirted leaders. Rudi Steiner was in peak condition.
Look, he pointed out. There's Deutscher.
Through the clusters of crowd, the blonde epitome of Hitler Youth standards was giving instructions to two members of his division. They were nodding and occasionally stretching. One of them shielded his eyes from the sun like a salute.
You want to say hello?
Liesel asked.
No thanks. I'll do that later.
When I've won. The words were not spoken, but they were definitely there, somewhere between Rudy's blue eyes and Deutscher's advisory hands. There was the obligatory march around the grounds, the anthem, Heil Hitler. Only then could they begin. When Rudy's age group was called for the 1500, Liesel wished him luck in a typically German manner.
Hals und Beinbruch, Sau Kerl!
She told him to break his neck and leg. Boys collected themselves on the far side of the circular field. Some stretched, some focused, and the rest were there because they had to be. Next to Liesel, Rudy's mother, Barbara, sat with her youngest children. A thin blanket was brimming with kids and loosened grass.
Can you see Rudy? She asked them. He's the one on the far left.
Barbara Steiner was a kind woman whose hair always looked recently combed.
Where?
Said one of the girls, probably Bettina, the youngest.
I can't see him at all.
That last one. No, not there. There.
They were still in the identification process when the starter's gun gave off its smoke and sound. The small Steiners rushed to the fence. For the first lap, a group of seven boys led the field. On the second, it dropped to five, and on the next lap, four. Rudy was the fourth runner on every lap until the last. A man on the right was saying that the boy coming second looked the best. He was the tallest.
You wait, he told his nonplussed wife. With 200 left, he'll break away.
The man was wrong. A gargantuan brown-shirted official informed the group that there was one lap to go. He certainly wasn't suffering under the ration system. He called out as the lead pack crossed the line, and it was not the second boy who accelerated, but the fourth. And he was 200 meters early. Rudy ran. He did not look back at any stage. Like an elastic rope, he lengthened his lead until any thought of someone else winning snapped altogether. He took himself around the track as the three runners behind him fought each other for the scraps. In the home stretch, there was nothing but blonde hair and space. And when he crossed the line, he didn't stop, he didn't raise his arm, there wasn't even a bent-over relief. He simply walked another 20 meters, and eventually looked over his shoulder to watch the others cross the line. On the way back to his family, he met first with his leaders, and then with Franz Deutscher. They both nodded.
Steiner?
Deutsche?
Looks like all those laps I gave you paid off. huh?
Looks like it. He would not smile until he'd won all four. A point for later reference. Not only was Rudy recognized now as a good school student, he was a gifted athlete, too. For Liesl, there was the 400. She finished seventh, then fourth in her heat of the 200. All she could see up ahead were the hamstrings and bobbing ponytails of the girls in front. In the long jump, she enjoyed the sand packed around her feet more than any distance, and the shot put wasn't her greatest moment either. This day, she realized, was Rudy's. In the 400 final, he led from the backstretch to the end, and he won the 200 only narrowly.
"You getting tired?" Liesl asked him.
It was early afternoon by then.
"Of course not."
He was breathing heavily and stretching his calves.
"What are you talking about, Zaumensch? What the hell would you know?"
When the heats of the 100 were called, he rose slowly to his feet and followed the trail of adolescents toward the track. Liesl went after him.
"Hey, Rudy."
She pulled at his shirt sleeve.
"Good luck." "I'm not tired," he said. "I know."
He winked at her. He was tired. In his heat, Rudy slowed to finish second, and after 10 minutes of other races, the final was called. Two other boys had looked formidable, and Liesl had a feeling in her stomach that Rudy could not win this one. Tommy Müller, who'd finished second to last in his heat, stood with her at the fence.
"He'll win it,"
he informed her.
"I know."
"No, he won't." When the finalists reached the starting line, Rudy dropped to his knees and began digging starting holes with his hands. A balding brown shirt wasted no time in walking over and telling him to cut it out. Liesl watched the adult finger, pointing, and she could see the dirt falling to the ground as Rudy brushed his hands together. When they were called forward, Liesl tightened her grip on the fence. One of the boys false started. The gun was shot twice. It was Rudy. Again, the official had words with him, and the boy nodded. Once more, and he was out. Set for the second time, Liesl watched with concentration, and for the first few seconds she could not believe what she was seeing. Another false start was recorded, and it was the same athlete who had done it. In front of her, she created a perfect race in which Rudy trailed but came home to win in the last 10 meters. What she actually saw, however, was Rudy's disqualification. He was escorted to the side of the track and was made to stand there alone as the remainder of boys stepped forward. They lined up and raced. A boy with rusty brown hair and a big stride won by at least 5 meters. Rudy remained. Later, when the day was complete and the sun was taken from Himmel Street, Liesl sat with her friend on the footpath. They talked about everything else, from Franz Deutsch's face after the 1500, to one of the 11-year-old girls having a tantrum after losing the discus. Before they proceeded to their respective homes, Rudy's voice reached over and handed Liesl the truth. For a while, it sat on her shoulder, but a few thoughts later, it made its way to her ear. Rudy's voice. "I did it on purpose." When the confession registered, Liesl asked the only question available.
"But why, Rudy? Why did you do it?"
He was standing with a hand on his hip, and he did not answer. There was nothing but a knowing smile and a slow walk that lulled him home. They never talked about it again. For Liesl's part, she often wondered what Rudy's answer might have been had she pushed him. Perhaps 3 medals had shown what he'd wanted to show, or he was afraid to lose that final race. In the end, the only explanation she allowed herself to hear was an inner teenage voice.
"Because he isn't Jesse Owens."
Only when she got up to leave did she notice the 3 imitation gold medals sitting next to her. She knocked on the Steiner's door and held them out to him.
"You forgot these."
"No, I didn't."
He closed the door, and Liesl took the medals home. She walked with them down to the basement and told Max about her friend, Rudi Steiner.
"He truly is stupid," she concluded.
"Clearly," Max agreed, but I doubt he was fooled. They both started work then, Max on his sketchbook, Liesl on the dream carrier. She was in the latter stages of the novel, where the young priest was doubting his faith after meeting a strange and elegant woman. When she placed it face down on her lap, Max asked when she thought she'd finish it.
"A few days, at the most."
"Then a new one?" The book thief looked at the basement ceiling.
"Maybe, Max."
She closed the book and leaned back.
"If I'm lucky."
The next book. It's not the Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus, as you might be expecting. No, the dictionary comes at the end of this small trilogy, and this is only the second installment. This is the part where Liesl finishes The Dream Carrier and steals a story called A Song in the Dark. As always, it was taken from the mayor's house. The only difference was that she made her way to the upper part of town alone. There was no Rudi that day. It was a morning rich with both sun and frothy clouds. Liesl stood in the mayor's library with greed in her fingers and book titles at her lips. She was comfortable enough on this occasion to run her fingers along the shelves, a short replay of her original visit to the room, and she whispered many of the titles as she made her way along. Under the Cherry Tree, The Tenth Lieutenant. Typically, many of the titles tempted her, but after a good minute or two in the room, she settled for A Song in the Dark, most likely because the book was green, and she did not yet own a book of that color. The engraved writing on the cover was white, and there was a small insignia of a flute between the title and the name of the author. She climbed with it from the window, saying thanks on her way out. Without Rudi, she felt a good degree of absence, but on that particular morning, for some reason, the book thief was happiest alone. She went about her work and read the book next to the Amper River, far away from the occasional headquarters of Victor Chemmel and the previous gang of Arthur Berg. No one came, no one interrupted, and Liesl read four of the very short chapters of A Song in the Dark, and she was happy. It was the pleasure and satisfaction of good stealing. A week later, the trilogy of happiness was completed. In the last days of August, a gift arrived, or in fact was noticed. It was late afternoon. Liesl was watching Christina Müller jumping rope on Himmel Street. Rudi Steiner skidded to a stop in front of her on his brother's bike.
"Do you have some time?" he asked.
She shrugged.
"For what?" "I think you'd better come."
He dumped the bike and went to collect the other one from home. In front of her, Liesl watched the pedal spin. They rode up to Grunderstrasse, where Rudi stopped and waited.
"Well?" Liesl asked. "What is it?"
Rudi pointed.
"Look closer."
Gradually they rode to a better position, behind a blue spruce tree. Through the prickly branches, Liesl noticed the closed window and then the object leaning on the glass.
"Is that?"
Rudi nodded. They debated the issue for many minutes before they agreed it needed to be done. It had obviously been placed there intentionally, and if it was a trap, it was worth it. Among the powdery blue branches, Liesl said,
"A book thief would do it."
She dropped the bike, observed the street, and crossed the yard. The shadows of clouds were buried among the dusky grass. Were they holes for falling into, or patches of extra darkness for hiding in? Her imagination sent her sliding down one of those holes into the evil clutches of the mayor himself. If nothing else, those thoughts distracted her, and she was at the window even quicker than she'd hoped. It was like the Whistler all over again. Her nerves licked her palms. Small streams of sweat rippled under her arms. When she raised her head, she could read the title. The Complete Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus. Briefly, she turned to Rudy and mouthed the words,
"It's a dictionary."
He shrugged and held out his arms. She worked methodically, sliding the window upward, wondering how all of this would look from inside the house. She envisioned the sight of her thieving hand reaching up, making the window rise until the book was felled. It seemed to surrender slowly, like a falling tree.
Got it. There was barely a disturbance or sound.
The book simply tilted toward her, and she took it with her free hand. She even closed the window, nice and smooth, then turned and walked back across the potholes of clouds.
"Nice," Ruby said as he gave her the bike. "Thank you."
They rode toward the corner where the day's importance reached them. Liesl knew. It was that feeling again, of being watched. A voice pedaled inside her, two laps.
"Look at the window. Look at the window."
She was compelled. Like an itch that demands a fingernail, she felt an intense desire to stop. She placed her feet on the ground and turned to face the mayor's house and the library window, and she saw. Certainly she should have known this might happen, but she could not hide the shock that loitered inside when she witnessed the mayor's wife standing behind the glass. She was transparent, but she was there. Her fluffy hair was as it always was, and her wounded eyes and mouth and expression held themselves up for viewing. Very slowly, she lifted her hand to the book thief on the street. A motionless wave. In her state of shock, Liesl said nothing to Rudy or herself. She only steadied herself and raised her hand to acknowledge the mayor's wife in the window. Duden Dictionary. Meaning number 2. Verzeihung. Forgiveness. To stop feeling anger, animosity, or resentment. Related words: absolution, acquittal, mercy. On the way home, they stopped at the bridge and inspected the heavy black book. As Rudy flipped through the pages, he arrived at a letter. He picked it up and looked slowly toward the book thief.
"It's got your name on it."
The river ran. Liesl took hold of the paper. The letter.
"Dear Liesl, I know you find me pathetic and loathsome. Look that word up if you don't know it. But I must tell you that I am not so stupid as to not see your footprints in the library. When I noticed the first book missing, I thought I had simply misplaced it. But then I saw the outlines of some feet on the floor in certain patches of the light. It made me smile. I was glad that you took what was rightfully yours. I then made the mistake of thinking that would be the end of it. When you came back, I should have been angry, but I wasn't. I could hear you the last time, but I decided to leave you alone. You only ever take one book, and it will take 1,000 visits till all of them are gone. My only hope is that one day you will knock on the front door and enter the library in the more civilized manner. Again, I am sorry we could no longer keep your foster mother employed. Lastly, I hope you find this dictionary and thesaurus useful as you read your stolen books. Yours sincerely, Ilse Hermann."
"We'd better head home," Rudy suggested. But Liesl did not go.
"Can you wait here for 10 minutes?
"Of course." Liesl struggled back up to 8 Grunderstrasse and sat on the familiar territory of the front entrance. The book was with Rudy, but she held the letter and rubbed her fingers on the folded paper as the steps grew heavier around her. She tried 4 times to knock on the daunting flesh of the door, but she could not bring herself to do it. The most she could accomplish was to place her knuckles gently on the warmness of the wood. Again, her brother found her. From the bottom of the steps, his knee healing nicely, he said,
"Come on, Liesl. Knock.
As she made her second getaway, she could soon see the distant figure of Rudy at the bridge. The wind showered through her hair. Her feet swam with the pedals. Liesel Memminger was a criminal, but not because she'd stolen a handful of books through an open window. You should have knocked, she thought, and although there was a good portion of guilt, there was also the juvenile trace of laughter. As she rode, she tried to tell herself something. You don't deserve to be this happy, Liesel. You really don't. Can a person steal happiness, or is it just another internal, infernal human trick? Liesel shrugged away from her thoughts. She crossed the bridge and told Rudy to hurry up and not to forget the book. They rode home on rusty bikes. They rode home a couple of miles, from summer to autumn, and from a quiet night to the noisy breath of the bombing of Munich. The Sound of Sirens. With the small collection of money Hans had earned in the summer, he brought home a second-hand radio. This way, he said, we can hear when the raids are coming even before the sirens start. They make a cuckoo sound and then announce the regions at risk. He placed it on the kitchen table and switched it on. They also tried to make it work in the basement for Max, but there was nothing but static and severed voices in the speakers. In September, they did not hear it as they slept. Either the radio was already half broken, or it was swallowed immediately by the crying sound of sirens. A hand was shoved gently at Liesel's shoulder as she slept. Papa's voice followed it in, afraid. Liesel, wake up. We have to go. There was the disorientation of interrupted sleep, and Liesel could barely decipher the outline of Papa's face. The only thing truly visible was his voice. In the hallway, they stopped. Wait, said Rosa. Through the dark, they rushed to the basement. The lamp was lit. Max edged out from behind the paint cans and drop sheets. His face was tired, and he hitched his thumbs nervously into his pants. Time to go, huh? Hans walked to him. Yes, time to go. He shook his hand and slapped his arm. We'll see you when we get back, right? Of course. Rosa hugged him, as did Liesel. Goodbye, Max. Weeks earlier, they discussed whether they should all stay together in their own basement, or if the three of them should go down the road, to a family by the name of Fiedler. It was Max who convinced them. They said it's not deep enough here. I've already put you in enough danger. Hans had nodded. It's a shame we can't take you with us. It's a disgrace. It's how it is. Outside, the sirens howled at the houses, and the people came running, hobbling, and recoiling as they exited their homes. Night watched. Some people watched it back, trying to find the tin can planes as they drove across the sky. Himmel Street was a procession of tangled people, all wrestling with their most precious possessions. In some cases, it was a baby. In others, a stack of photo albums or a wooden box. Liesel carried her books between her arm and her ribs. Frau Holzapfel was heaving a suitcase, laboring on the footpath with bulbous eyes and small-stepped feet. Papa, who'd forgotten everything, even his accordion, rushed back to her and rescued the suitcase from her grip. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what have you got in here?" he asked. "An anvil?" Frau Holzapfel advanced alongside him. "The necessities?" The Fiedlers lived six houses down. They were a family of four, all with wheat-coloured hair and good German eyes. More important, they had a nice, deep basement. 22 people crammed themselves into it, including the Steiner family, Frau Holzapfel, Pfiffikus, a young man, and a family named Jensen. In the interest of a civil environment, Rosa Hubermann and Frau Holzapfel were kept separated, though some things were above petty arguments. One light globe dangled from the ceiling, and the room was dank and cold. Jagged walls jutted out and poked people in the back as they stood and spoke. The muffled sound of sirens leaked in from somewhere. They could hear a distorted version of them that somehow found a way inside. Although creating considerable apprehension about the quality of the shelter, they at least could hear the three sirens that would signal the end of the raid and safety. They didn't need a Luftschutzwart, an air raid supervisor. It wasn't long before Rudy found Liesel and was standing next to her. His hair was pointing at something on the ceiling.
"Isn't this great?"
She couldn't resist some sarcasm.
"It's lovely." "Ah, come on, Liesel, don't be like that. What's the worst that can happen, apart from all of us being flattened or fried or whatever bombs do?"
Liesel looked around, gauging the faces. She started compiling a list of who was most afraid. The hit list. 1, Frau Holzapfel. 2, Mr. Fiedler. 3, the young man. 4, Rosa Huberman. Frau Holzapfel's eyes were trapped open. Her wiry frame was stooped forward, and her mouth was a circle. Herr Fiedler busied himself by asking people, sometimes repeatedly, how they were feeling. The young man, Rolf Schulz, kept to himself in the corner, speaking silently at the air around him, castigating it. His hands were cemented into his pockets. Rosa rocked back and forth, ever so gently.
"Liesel," she whispered.
"Come here."
She held the girl from behind, tightening her grip. She sang a song, but it was so quiet that Liesel could not make it out. The notes were borne on her breath, and they died at her lips. Next to them, Papa remained quiet and motionless. At one point, he placed his warm hand on Liesel's cool skull. "You'll live," it said, and it was right. To their left, Alex and Barbara Steiner stood with the younger of their children, Emma and Bettina. The two girls were attached to their mother's right leg. The oldest boy, Kurt, stared ahead in a perfect Hitler Youth stance, holding the hand of Karin, who was tiny, even for her 7 years. The 10-year-old Anna Marie played with the pulpy surface of the cement wall. On the other side of the Steiners were Pfiffikus and the Jensen family. Pfiffikus kept himself from whistling. The bearded Mr. Jensen held his wife tightly, and their two kids drifted in and out of silence. Occasionally they pestered each other, but they held back when it came to the beginning of true argument. After 10 minutes or so, what was most prominent in the cellar was a kind of non-movement. The bodies were welded together, and only their feet changed position or pressure. Stillness was shackled to their faces. They watched each other and waited. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 3. Angst, fear, an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger. Related words, terror, horror, panic, fright, alarm. From other shelters, there were stories of singing Deutschland über alles, or of people arguing amid the staleness of their own breath. No such things happened in the Fiedler shelter. In that place, there was only fear and apprehension, and the dead song at Rosa Huberman's cardboard lips. Not long before the sirens signaled the end, Alex Steiner, the man with the immovable wooden face, coaxed the kids from his wife's legs. He was able to reach out and grapple for his son's free hand. Kurt, still stoic and full of stare, took it up and tightened his grip gently on the hand of his sister. Soon, everyone in the cellar was holding the hand of another, and the group of Germans stood in a lumpy circle. The cold hands melted into the warm ones, and in some cases the feeling of another human pulse was transported. It came through the layers of pale, stiffened skin. Some of them closed their eyes, waiting for their final demise, or hoping for a sign that the raid was finally over. Did they deserve any better, these people? How many had actively persecuted others, high on the scent of Hitler's gaze, repeating his sentences, his paragraphs, his opus? Was Rosa Huberman responsible, the hider of a Jew, or Hans? Did they all deserve to die? The children? The answer to each of these questions interests me very much, though I cannot allow them to seduce me. I only know that all of those people would have sensed me that night, excluding the youngest of the children. I was the suggestion. I was the advice. My imagined feet walking into the kitchen and down the corridor. As is often the case with humans, when I read about them in the book thief's words, I pitied them, though not as much as I felt for the ones I scooped up from various camps in that time. The Germans in basements were pitiable, surely, but at least they had a chance. That basement was not a washroom. They were not sent there for a shower. For those people, life was still achievable. In the uneven circle, the minutes soaked by. Liesel held Rudy's hand and her mama's. Only one thought saddened her. Max. How would Max survive if the bombs arrived on Himmel Street? Around her, she examined the Fiedler's basement. It was much sturdier and considerably deeper than the one at 33 Himmel Street. Silently, she asked her papa, "Are you thinking about him too?" Whether the silent question registered or not, he gave the girl a quick nod. It was followed a few minutes later by the three sirens of temporary peace. The people at 45 Himmel Street sank with relief. Some clenched their eyes and opened them again. A cigarette was passed around. Just as it made its way to Rudy Steiner's lips, it was snatched away by his father. "Not you, Jesse Owens." The children hugged their parents, and it took many minutes for all of them to fully realize that they were alive, and that they were going to be alive. Only then did their feet climb the stairs to Herbert Fiedler's kitchen. Outside, a procession of people made its way silently along the street. Many of them looked up and thanked God for their lives. When the Hubermans made it home, they headed directly to the basement. But it seemed that Max was not there. The lamp was small and orange, and they could not see him or hear an answer. "Max? He's disappeared."
"Max, are you there?"
"I'm here." They originally thought the words had come from behind the drop sheets and paint cans, but Liesel was first to see him, in front of them. His jaded face was camouflaged among the painting materials and fabric. He was sitting there, with stunned eyes and lips. When they walked across, he spoke again. "I couldn't help it," he said. It was Rosa who replied. She crouched down to face him.
"What are you talking about, Max?"
"I..." he struggled to answer. When everything was quiet, I went up to the corridor, and the curtain in the living room was open, just a crack. I could see outside. I watched, only for a few seconds. He had not seen the outside world for 22 months. There was no anger or reproach. It was Papa who spoke. "How did it look?" Max lifted his head with great sorrow and great astonishment. "There were stars," he said. "They burned my eyes." Four of them, two people on their feet, the other two remained seated. All had seen a thing or two that night. This place was the real basement. This was the real fear. Max gathered himself and stood to move back behind the sheets. He wished them good night, but he didn't make it beneath the stairs. With Mama's permission, Liesel stayed with him till morning, reading a song in the dark, as he sketched and wrote in his book. "From a Himmel Street window," he wrote, "the stars set fire to my eyes." The Sky Stealer. The first raid, as it turned out, was not a raid at all. Had people waited to see the planes, they would have stood there all night. That accounted for the fact that no cuckoo had called from the radio. The Malking Express reported that a certain flak tower operator had become a little overexcited. He'd sworn that he could hear the rattle of planes and see them on the horizon. He sent the word.
"He might have done it on purpose," Hans Huberman pointed out. "Would you want to sit in a flak tower, shooting up at planes carrying bombs?"
Sure enough, As Max continued reading the article in the basement, it was reported that the man with the outlandish imagination had been stood down from his original duty. His fate was most likely some sort of service elsewhere. "Good luck to him," Max said. He seemed to understand as he moved on to the crossword. The next raid was real. On the night of September the 19th, the cuckoo called from the radio, and it was followed by a deep, informative voice. It listed Mulking as a possible target. Again, Himmel Street was a trail of people, and again, Papa left his accordion. Rosa reminded him to take it, but he refused. "I didn't take it last time," he explained, "and we lived." War clearly blurred the distinction between logic and superstition. Eerie air followed them down to the Fiedler's basement. "I think it's real tonight," said Mr. Fiedler, and the children quickly realized that their parents were even more afraid this time around. Reacting the only way they knew, the youngest of them began to wail and cry as the room seemed to swing. Even from the cellar, they could vaguely hear the tune of bombs. Air pressure shoved itself down like a ceiling, as if to mash the earth. A bite was taken of Mulking's empty streets. Rosa held furiously onto Liesl's hand. The sound of crying children kicked and punched. Even Rudy stood completely erect, feigning nonchalance, tensing himself against the tension. Arms and elbows fought for room. Some of the adults tried to calm the infants. Others were unsuccessful in calming themselves.
"Shut that kid up!"
Frau Holzapfel clamored, but her sentence was just another hapless voice in the warm chaos of the shelter. Grimy tears were loosened from children's eyes, and the smell of night breath, underarm sweat, and overworn clothes was stirred and stewed in what was now a cauldron swimming with humans. Although they were right next to each other, Liesl was forced to call out,
"Mama!"
Again,
"Mama! You're squashing my hand!"
"What?"
"My hand!"
Rosa released her, and for comfort, to shut out the din of the basement, Liesl opened one of her books and began to read. The book on top of the pile was The Whistler, and she spoke it aloud to help her concentrate. The opening paragraph was numb in her ears.
"What did you say?" Mama roared,
but Liesl ignored her. She remained focused on the first page. When she turned to page 2, it was Rudy who noticed. He paid direct attention to what Liesl was reading, and he tapped his brother and his sisters, telling them to do the same. Hans Hubermann came closer and called out, and soon a quietness started bleeding through the crowded basement. By page 3, everyone was silent but Liesl. She didn't dare to look up, but she could feel their frightened eyes hanging onto her as she hauled the words in and breathed them out. A voice played the notes inside her. "This," it said, "is your accordion." The sound of the turning page carved them in half. Liesl read on. For at least 20 minutes, she handed out the story. The youngest kids were soothed by her voice, and everyone else saw visions of the Whistler running from the crime scene. Liesl did not. The book thief saw only the mechanics of the words, their bodies stranded on the paper, beaten down for her to walk on. Somewhere, too, in the gaps between a period and the next capital letter, there was also Max. She remembered reading to him when he was sick. "Is he in the basement?" she wondered. "Or is he stealing a glimpse of the sky again?" A nice thought. One was a book thief. The other stole the sky. Everyone waited for the ground to shake. That was still an immutable fact, but at least they were distracted now by the girl with the book. One of the younger boys contemplated crying again, but Liesl stopped at that moment and imitated her papa, or even Rudy for that matter. She winked at him and resumed. Only when the sirens leaked into the cellar again did someone interrupt her.
"We're safe," said Mr. Jensen.
"Shh," said Frau Holzapfel.
Liesl looked up.
"There are only 2 paragraphs till the end of the chapter," she said,
and she continued reading with no fanfare or added speed. just the words. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 4. Wort, word, a meaningful unit of language, a promise, a short remark, statement, or conversation. Related words, term, name, expression. Out of respect, the adults kept everyone quiet, and Liesl finished chapter 1 of The Whistler. On their way up the stairs, the children rushed by her, but many of the older people, even Frau Holzapfel, even Pfiffikus, how appropriate, considering the title she read from, thanked the girl for the distraction. They did so as they made their way past, and hurried from the house to see if Himmelstreet had sustained any damage. Himmelstreet was untouched. The only sign of war was a cloud of dust migrating from east to west. It looked through the windows, trying to find a way inside, and as it simultaneously thickened and spread, it turned the trail of humans into apparitions. There were no people on the street anymore. They were rumors carrying bags. At home, Papa told Max all about it. "There's fog and ash. I think they let us out too early." He looked to Rosa. "Should I go out to see if they need help where the bombs dropped?" Rosa was not impressed. "Don't be so idiotic," she said. "You'll choke on the dust." "No, no, Saukel, you're staying here." A thought came to her. She looked at Hans very seriously now. In fact, her face was crayoned with pride. "Stay here and tell him about the girl." Her voice loudened just slightly. "About the book." Max gave her some added attention. "The Whistler," Rosa informed him. "Chapter 1. She explained exactly what had happened in the shelter. As Liesl stood in a corner of the basement, Max watched her and rubbed a hand along his jaw. Personally, I think that was the moment he conceived the next body of work for his sketchbook. The Word Shaker. He imagined the girl reading in the shelter. He must have watched her literally handing out the words. However, as always, he must also have seen the shadow of Hitler. He could probably already hear his footsteps coming toward Himmelstreet and the basement for later. After a lengthy pause, he looked ready to speak, but Liesl beat him to it. "Did you see the sky tonight?" "No." Max looked at the wall and pointed. On it, they all watched the words and the picture he'd painted more than a year earlier, the rope and the dripping sun. "Only that one tonight." And from there, no more was spoken. Nothing but thoughts. Max, Hans, and Rosa I cannot account for, but I know that Liesl Memminger was thinking that if the bombs ever landed on Himmelstreet, not only did Max have less chance of survival than everyone else, but he would die completely alone. Frau Holzapfel's offer. In the morning, the damage was inspected. No one died, but 2 apartment blocks were reduced to pyramids of rubble, and Rudi's favorite Hitler Youth Field had an enormous bowl spooned out of it. Half the town stood around its circumference. People estimated its depth to compare it with their shelters. Several boys and girls spat into it. Rudi was standing next to Liesl. "Looks like they need to fertilize again." When the next few weeks were raid-free, life almost returned to normal. 2 telling moments, however, were on their way. The dual events of October. The hands of Frau Holzapfel. The parade of Jews. Her wrinkles were like slander. Her voice was akin to a beating with a stick. It was actually quite fortunate that they saw Frau Holzapfel coming from the living room window, for her knuckles on the door were hard and decisive. They meant business. Liesl heard the words she dreaded. "You go and answer it," Mama said, and the girl, knowing only too well what was good for her, did as she was told. "Is your Mama home?" Frau Holzapfel inquired. Constructed of 50-year-old wire, she stood on the front step, looking back every so often to view the street.
Is that swine of a mother of yours here today?
Liesel turned and called out. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 5. Gelegenheit, opportunity. A chance for advancement or progress. Related words? Prospect, opening, break. Soon Rosa was behind her.
What do you want here? You want to spit on my kitchen floor now, too?
Frau Holzapfel was not deterred in the slightest.
Is that how you greet everyone who shows up at your front door? What a gesindel!
Liesel watched. She was unfortunate enough to be sandwiched between them. Rosa pulled her out of the way.
Well, are you going to tell me why you're here or not?
Frau Holzapfel looked once more at the street and back.
I have an offer for you. Mama shifted her weight. Is that right? No, not you.
She dismissed Rosa with a shrug of the voice and focused now on Liesel.
You. Why did you ask for me, then? Well, I at least need your permission.
Oh, Maria, Liesel thought, this is all I need. What the hell can Holzapfel want with me?
I like that book you read in the shelter.
No, you're not getting it. Liesel was convinced of that.
Yes? I was hoping to hear the rest of it in the shelter, but it looks like we're safe for now.
She rolled her shoulders and straightened the wire in her back.
So I want you to come to my place and read it to me. You've got some nerve, Holzapfel.
Rosa was deciding whether to be furious or not.
If you think... I'll stop spitting on your door, she interrupted, and I'll give you my coffee ration.
Rosa decided against being furious.
And some flour? What are you, a Jew? Just the coffee. You can swap the coffee with someone else for the flour.
It was decided, by everyone but the girl.
Good then, it's done. Mama? Quiet, Salmensch. Go and get the book.
Mama faced Frau Holzapfel again.
What days suit you? Monday and Friday, 4 o'clock. And today, right now.
Liesel followed the regimented footsteps to Frau Holzapfel's lodging next door, which was a mirror image of the Hubermann's. If anything, it was slightly larger. When she sat down at the kitchen table, Frau Holzapfel sat directly in front of her, but faced the window.
Read,
she said.
Chapter 2?
No, Chapter 8. Of course Chapter 2. Now get reading before I throw you out.
Yes, Frau Holzapfel.
Never mind the yes, Frau Holzapfels. Just open the book. We don't have all day.
Good God, Liesel thought. This is my punishment for all that stealing. It's finally caught up with me. She read for 45 minutes, and when the chapter was finished, a bag of coffee was deposited on the table.
Thank you, the woman said. It's a good story.
She turned toward the stove and started on some potatoes. Without looking back, she said,
Are you still here, are you?
Liesel took that as her cue to leave.
Danke schön, Frau Holzapfel.
By the door, when she saw the framed photos of 2 young men in military uniform, she also threw in a Heil Hitler, her arm raised in the kitchen.
Yes,
Frau Holzapfel was proud and afraid. 2 sons in Russia.
Heil Hitler.
She put her water down to boil, and even found the manners to walk the few steps with Liesel to the front door.
This morgen?
The next day was Friday.
Yes, Frau Holzapfel. Until tomorrow.
Liesel calculated that there were 4 more reading sessions like that with Frau Holzapfel before the Jews were marched through Mulkin. They were going to Dachau to concentrate. That makes 2 weeks, she would later write in the basement. 2 weeks to change the world, and 14 days to ruin it. The Long Walk to Dachau. Some people said that the truck had broken down, but I can personally testify that this was not the case. I was there. What had happened was an ocean sky with white-cap clouds. Also, there was more than just the one vehicle. 3 trucks don't all break down at once. When the soldiers pulled over to share some food and cigarettes and to poke at the package of Jews, one of the prisoners collapsed from starvation and sickness. I have no idea where the convoy had travelled from, but it was perhaps 4 miles from Malking,